Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it mean to like a product or service or a piece of content in social media? And is that expression of approval an act of empowerment or a surrendering of control and personal information? As my guest today has discovered, likes have become a coveted form of social currency online. And while young people might seek them because they convey peer approval, corporations have realized they offer direct access to an entire generation of potential customers. Author and media scholar Douglas Rushkoff served as correspondent for the Frontline documentary Generation Like. The show airs tomorrow night, February 18th at 9 o'clock on KERA Channel 13 television. Doug, welcome back to Think.
Hi, great to be with you.
This documentary is a reminder that new technologies have given companies, among others, a kind of direct access to teenagers that is unprecedented in history. And then kids can trade back information about themselves in like a fraction of a second.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, in the old days, companies had to chase down kids. You know, they would follow them with people called cool hunters and all sorts of teen researchers and 20-somethings out there pretending to be teens. And kids would be, you know, it was sort of a cat-and-mouse game. Kids would run, and they would try to keep their scene from being noticed, because once it got noticed, it would be thrown on MTV, and then it wouldn't be cool anymore. And now, kids aren't running from these market researchers at all. If anything, kids are creating their own market research consumer profiles online and broadcasting them and hoping to get noticed. You know, they want a brand or a snack food or a soft drink to notice their profile and to start tweeting about them. So it's kind of the exact opposite of the way it was 10 or 20 years ago.
Well, it's funny that you said old days, because you defined it exactly like my kids do, like anything before 2005. It has really changed that quickly.
I mean, in some ways it has. I mean, maybe it goes back and forth. I mean, in some ways, you know, where when I was a little kid, there were hippies out there. And then by the time I was in college, people were yuppies. Mm-hmm. And then I got out of college and they were slackers and grunge people. And now it's kind of gone back the other way. But, you know, these kids, as far as I could tell, these teenagers are certainly with the program. You know, they want to be recognized by marketers. They want marketers to understand what they like and don't like. And many of them actually want to become marketers themselves. They see, marketing as the art form and the ideal profession of the century.
So for people who are maybe not heavily engaged in social media, Doug, can you explain what like means for purposes of this discussion?
Yeah, there's a number of ways through the internet, whether it's online on computers or on little applications on people's smartphones. There's ways to post either words that you've written, you know, short sentences called tweets. You can put up pictures of yourself called, like Instagram photos, or you can put up updates, you know, different a sentence or two about, you know, what's going on with you now. And everything that you put up is visible to everybody else, and they can click on it if they like it, you know, or they can click on it and say, this is my favorite, or they can even repost it. They can click on it in such a way that now they broadcast it to everyone in their network. So really what we're looking at is a way of putting a profile of yourself, like a picture of yourself or a channel of just you online, and then you try to get as many subscribers to that channel, as many followers as possible, and get as many of those people then clicking on your work, that they like you, or they like your picture, or they like your song. And those likes really are the currency of this realm, where one kid may have 10 or 15 likes for his profile on Facebook, and another person may have 1,000, 10,000, or even 1 million likes, you know, if they're a celebrity in this space.
It does seem that adolescence has become less a period of personal exploration than a period of refining one's personal brand.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it occurred to me, I was watching kids as they assemble their Facebook wall. That's mm-hmm. There's a term called wall, which is basically like your web page, your home page on Facebook. And kids, you know, put all these different things up. They'll put pictures of their favorite band, and they'll click on what books they like, what's their favorite food, what are their favorite restaurants. It's like creating this kind of online consumer profile of yourself. And I was trying to think if there were analogs to this when I was a kid. And, you know, the equivalent was the bedroom wall, you know, where we would, you know, you'd go to, gosh, this dates me, but we used to go to a place called Spencer Gifts in the mall.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And you'd, you know, buy a poster. Remember those places?
Glow
you buy
in the
a
dark,
poster,
yes.
Like, you know, yeah, Glow in the Dark or Farrah Fawcett or Lee Majors or this, you know, whatever, The Clash, you know, is about as modern as I got. You know, and you'd put those on your bedroom wall. And your friend might come in and see, oh, you like this band, you like that. Oh, this is cool. That's not cool. But it was a way of reflecting your, you know, your cultural tastes back to yourself. You know, now that wall is a public wall. They're putting things up not as a personal experiment or reflection, but as a performative act to the world. And not only that, but trying to get approval from the entire world for each of those things. It's a very different, really very different way of developing, a sense of who you are.
And the reason that those likes are so important to marketers is that, for one thing, if the folks at, I don't know what you snack on, if people say, oh, well, Doug Brushkoff likes Cheetos, they can tell all your friends that you've said you like Cheetos.
Yeah, I mean, well, likes matter. I mean, likes matter to different people. For different reasons. I mean, to the average kid, they matter for the same reason that they manage to your that they matter to your radio show. In other words, you put out a tweet. Oh, we're going to have, you know, Doug Rushkoff on the show today, and you hope then that people go, oh, I like Rushkoff. I'll favorite that, and I'm going to retweet that in the hopes of getting listeners to the show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the same that a kid wants. On the first level, to get retweeted or favorited by other people in their world so that they make more friends, so that more people notice them. Oh, you know, Jane's going to be in the school play and she wants people to know that. Or Jane went to this party and doesn't her new dress look sexy, you know? And then, oh, yay, the boys think I'm sexy. You know, so it's a way of just doing kind of publicity in your own world. And brands have that desire for sure, where they just want, oh, you know, Coca-Cola has a new beverage and they want everybody tweeting and favoriting and passing around the picture of the bottle, or a new movie comes out and they want publicity. So rather than just putting ads on TV, they'll get people to tweet about it or to Facebook about it. And everybody finds out through this kind of online word of mouth. But then there's this other level where they send out tweets and they want people, you know, tweeting or updating or liking, not just for the first level of publicity, but because it's like mining for information. When they can see, how did that message spread? They can see, oh, who are the influencers in our consumer community? Who do other people listen to? What messaging spread quickly and what messaging didn't spread? So it's like one giant consumer testing big data operation at this other level that's a bit more hidden to the general public.
And many young people not only see nothing strange about this, but they are participating willingly so that, well, talk, for example, about how Hunger Games publicists have used this reality that exists today.
Well, I mean, what you have to realize is likes and follows and retweets and all are really the currency of this culture. I mean, I would argue of this whole generation right now, but certainly of the online social media kids. You know, this is what they live for. They've done it enough. They've been on enough that that's what they think. That's what I've got to get. So when marketers understand that, they create opportunities for kids to get more followers, to get more likes. So they supply kids with the kinds of information and photos and tidbits that can get them popular. So if you're a fan of The Hunger Games, you might sign up for certain lists or visit certain kinds of websites so that you're the first one amongst your friends to know, oh, this person was cast in that show. Or you're the first person who sees the photo of the costume that they're going to use in a certain scene. So you want to get there early so then you can post that on your Facebook page or you can put that on your Instagram feed, and then other people will see your version of it. They'll see your instance of it for the first time. So that's the version that they will tweet or that they will Instagram. So it's a little bit like a pyramid scheme where the closer you can get to the source of the information, the more likely you are to be the one who spread it. And then you're going to get likes and follows and retweets as a result. So that's really the kind of game that these kids are playing.
And it starts to, I mean, in some ways it looks very organic, right? Everybody's tweeting about this. Everybody's posting on Facebook about this. Everyone's putting pictures on Instagram about this particular thing. But very often at the heart of it is a corporate marketing campaign.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It looks organic. It looks natural, especially to kids who've been raised with Facebook always being here. I mean, for you or me, you know, we were alive before the internet was around.
Right.
So we understand that the internet is not part of the natural landscape, right? It was created by people and it's owned by big corporations that have very particular agendas of how this technology should be used. You know, for a kid who was raised in a world where, well, Facebook is how you make friends, Twitter is how you announce something, Instagram is where pictures happen, they don't think of it as a corporate platform. They just think of it as the world. So they don't really, they don't see to this the extent to which this landscape is tilted towards certain kinds of behaviors. In other words, these, if the internet itself wasn't built as a marketing platform, but certainly, you know, Facebook and Instagram were built as marketing platforms. These are huge, or at least hugely valuated NASDAQ companies whose valuations are based on little more than the traffic that they get. You know, it's a lot less about the money that they've earned than the number of likes and things that they can generate. So, you know, they win either way. And I feel like in some cases, the companies who are using this are getting, in some sense, shafted almost as much as the kids who are using it. I don't know if it really leads to, you know, more people buying this soft drink or that or getting these pretzels, but it certainly leads to a lot of software companies and application companies getting paid to create traffic on their networks.
What do teenagers mean when they talk about social media as a source of empowerment?
Oh, it's interesting. I mean, on the one hand, it's kind of obvious, and this is what I argued really throughout the 90s, was until recently, media was a one-way street. You picked what channel you were going to watch or what station you were going to listen to, and you received your media. These kids are growing up in a world where they can as likely be making media as watching media. And that in itself is empowering. They make the movies, they write the blog posts, and they tell each other what it is that they like and don't like. They can promote a brand online, you know, some of the ones they choose they do, or they can kill a brand online by not retweeting any of it. So at least on the surface, we're looking at a pretty empowering place.
We're speaking this hour with author and media scholar Douglas Rushkoff, correspondent for the Frontline documentary Generation Like, which airs this Tuesday, February 18th at 9 o'clock on KERA Channel 13 Television. If you'd like to join the conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372, send email to think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Author and media scholar Douglas Rushkoff is correspondent for the Frontline documentary Generation Like that airs this Tuesday, February 18th on KERA Channel 13 television. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Okay, Doug, the time was that the only people who imagined they might have fans were what we now call traditional media celebrities. But these days, it's possible to put a video on YouTube and really build a following from the ground up. Can you tell us about Tyler Oakley?
Yeah, it's interesting. He's an interesting case, kind of a hybrid case here, because what we were talking about before was how kids, they want to get popular online. So they'll see an advertisement or a tweet or something from a major brand, and then they might retweet it or favorite it in the hopes of getting noticed by that brand, right? So if Pepsi or Coke or Oreos or somebody puts out a piece of media and I comment on it in just the right way, my hope is then that Pepsi or Coke or Nabisco or someone will notice that. They'll favorite my comment or my picture. So when brands put out these the equivalent of advertisements in social media, it's with the hope that kids will respond to them, and kids are doing it with the implicit payback that they're going to get noticed, that someone's going to notice it, and then they'll get famous as a result. So I'll get more likes by liking Coke. Well, this kid, Tyler, he started doing that when he was in college. He would start, calling out to rock stars or to, pop stars or brands. And because he was personable, he had a large following of young girls, of 13, 14-year-old girls. He calls himself a fangirl and kind of plays this kind of over-the-top kind of a gay, product hound. The companies started following him too, so he'll reach out to Taco Bell and say, oh, I want, I would love to see a Taco Bell taco that tasted like I wanted to taste. And Taco Bell then responds to him, or he, sent his photo in when Beyonce was doing a Super Bowl halftime show in which she included the photos of the selfies, as they're called, of hundreds of different fans. His photo was included, or he tweeted to the band One Direction, and then they tweeted back. And he, over the years now, he's made a career of this. So he gets asked by a company to incorporate us, do what's the social media equivalent of a product placement into his YouTube show or into his tweets and Instagrams. And it's supposed to all feel kind of natural, but his job is being a product spokesman.
And he has said flat out, like, once a company, I forget the exact language he uses, but like, once they've shown they trust me, I'm really inclined to do all kinds of great things for them.
Yeah, well, by trust me, he means let him come up with the what in advertising used to be called the creative mm-hmm. around the thing. So he doesn't want to be given a script. Like, okay, just read this and put it in one of your videos. He wants to incorporate it into his shtick so that it's something that makes sense to him. So then he could use he uses the F word or whatever when he's doing something. So it looks less to his followers like he's just kind of sold out and more like he's, doing something that's natural to him, that these are products and stars that he really likes.
At one point, Doug, you decided to ask teenagers how they defined the term sell out. You got an interesting response.
I know. It was a funny thing. I should just keep that clip right here so I could play it for you. We ask kids. It was partly because of this Tyler stuff. I'm thinking, gosh, this kid, he's so obviously sold out. He's got millions of followers. Does anybody care about this? So I started asking kids about, what does it mean to sell out? And none of them even knew the term. It floored me. They said, sell out? You mean like have no tickets left for your concert? That was the only meaning of it that they could understand. It just struck me because, you know, as a Generation X person, you know, I've suffered to not ever be perceived of, even to myself, of having sold out in any way. To these kids, there's no distinction. It doesn't even mean anything. I mean, in some ways, maybe it's more honest, but in the other, the thing that concerns me, that bothers me about it is I think they don't really recognize that they're living and operating on a landscape that was made to market. Mm-hmm. You know, they're living in the shopping mall. They're living in the advertisement. And I guess if the advertisement is your natural environment, you're not going to see it as something strange. You're just going to see it as a means to an end. I'm going to get a lot of followers so that I can get a job. I'm going to get even as a writer. I mean, if you're starting out as a writer or a radio person now, the way you get your job is you show that you have a following on Twitter, that your Tumblr has a lot of people who read it, that you get this many hits. You know, these are the metrics by which people are judged in this century. So to some extent, it's the marketing that comes first, you know, and the marketing in the end, the following that you've been able to accumulate, your social network is the thing you have to sell.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Christian in Dallas. Hey, Christian.
Hi, thanks so much. This is such a great topic. I'm curious if you have any thoughts around how schools and educators can be using some of these best practices or some of this thinking and knowledge to help increase student achievement. Every time I go and meet with different schools or educators are always saying, how do we engage students? How do we engage young people? And yet there are these brands and these you know, musicians and artists that are constantly engaging them. And it seems as if educators are not paying attention. Do you have any thoughts or suggestions that they could use?
Thanks for your call.
It's funny. I mean, maybe I'm tacking left when I should tack right. But I mean, it's my opinion that schools get in trouble when they try to compete with these services on their own terms. In other words, if you try to use iPads and social networking and videos and all to try to somehow distract kids from the major brands and pop stars out there, you're going to lose. You know, what you do have, if your kids are coming to an actual school, you've got the home field advantage of the real world. You know, and I think that the thing to impress upon people, the things to learn how to do is, how do we take FaceTime? How do we take real bodies in a room together and impress upon young people how profound that is? You know, what is the 93% of human communication that happens nonverbally? You know, what is eye contact about? What is body language? What is rapport between people who are living in a space together? So I think when schools have kids all get computers and they all sit staring at either smart boards or little screens on their laps, they're back where they are at home anyway. You know, I think that the precious part of school is that you get FaceTime. So I guess that's sort of my stance on it. The other thing to do, I mean, that's really why I made this documentary, is to show kids the wizard behind the curtain, is to help kids understand who made these platforms. What are you paying for them? Oh, you're not paying money. Okay, does that mean they're free? How does the company make its money? Who is the real customer of Facebook? If you're not paying them and you're not the customer, oh, it's that marketing company that's paying them. So if you're not the customer of Facebook, what are you? Oh, you're the product of Facebook. Or what about all those hours that you spend making your profile? Oh, you're the worker of Facebook. Are they paying you for that? No. So it's those kinds of conversations to help them sort of denaturalize these platforms, to help them see them as inventions created by people and companies with agendas. It kind of helps them get on top of it a bit.
So there's no question, Doug, that people of our generation use social media to talk about a lot of nonsense, right, and to do a lot of nonsense. But there are also more substantive conversations happening, and these are tools for sort of civil discourse and engagement. Is there reason to hope that the millennial generation, although they're quite young right now, will mature into an expanded use of these technologies?
I mean, I would hope so. The problem is the expanded use of these technologies doesn't necessarily help the companies who are paying for them. You know, the people who are paying for these platforms, how do they benefit from some extended civil discourse going on? No, they benefit much more from the kind of car crash-like sensationalism that currently characterizes YouTube and Instagram and these other places. They want people clicking on lots of stuff fast. And that doesn't mean sitting listening to an hour-long NPR podcast. It means moving from this thing to that thing to this thing to that thing so that more ads can be served and more more data can be collected.
All right, let's talk about this, because I think, you know, it's not a new thing for young people to wish to be famous, right? That's existed for a long time, at least as long as we've had the modern sort of media, even predating the internet. But the idea that you had to have some kind of talent was always a component of that. I think the story here of Stephen Fernandez, who does have talent, but whose output on YouTube has shifted, is really interesting. Can you tell us about him?
Yeah, he's a sweet kid, you know, 13-year-old kid from, you know, what could only be called the ghetto of Los Angeles, trying to get enough money to get his family out of there. You know, he was a good little skateboarder, and he made some skateboard videos and got some likes and some attention on YouTube, you know, not thousands, but enough. But what happened was he started to put, you know, scantily clad, you know, Latina models in his videos, or started to do, you know, strange and disgusting stuff and makes really raunchy, sexy kind of porn jokes. And those got him a lot of attention, because a lot of people like seeing this sweet looking little 13-year-old kid talking dirty and doing all these strange things. And, you know, so as he made more videos, he got more attention, more likes, and ultimately sponsors and views and, you know, stuff and money for bigger videos. And now he gets, you know, he has 1 million followers on his YouTube channel. That's a lot. That's real numbers. So it ends up kind of changing who you are and what you do, because the thing you're rewarded for is not your talent. It's not your singing. It's, you know, it's kind of the raunch. It's the, in some ways, it's the Jerry Springer stage. You know, that's what I'm hoping. You know, just as when cable television came around and everything got really raunchy on TV for a while, and, you know, all the news channels were just having people fight with each other, and, you know, and the TV shows were these, you know, crazy wrestling matches between, you know, the baby mama dad of this one and that, you know, it was just crazy stuff. So hopefully it's that kind of terrible twos phase. But if the platforms themselves are geared to reward that, if really all you want is a hit, and if the more hits the better, then I don't think it's going to be our highest art and our best stuff, our most compelling things. You know, you're not going to get Bob Dylan or The Sopranos if it's just based on how many people are going to click on this thing in the first minute it's up. You know, you're going to get this kid, Stephen Hernandez, who's now called Baby Scumbag. You know, that's the direction it's going to go.
Well, as you mentioned, the jury's still out as to whether this all really works for corporations that are trying now to advertise this way and to reach these audiences. But it seems like lots of companies, if they're guaranteed, you know, 36,000 hits on an ad, wherever it is, if they could get 36,000 people paying attention to their TV commercial, if it's the right audience, that's great. And they're not paying much for the talent who is providing these endorsements.
Well, right. I mean, they're not paying much at all. It's changing, though. You know, there's a guy we look at in the movie named Oliver Luckett,
yeah,
who runs a new talent agency in Beverly Hills called The Audience. It's kind of a spinoff of William Morris Agency in some ways, or at least William Morris is a big investor in it. And what they are really social media agents. So they find talent and or they're hired by talent to help build the social media careers of different, you know, of a singer or a TV star. So the, you know, Ian Somerhalder is in our movie and he's the star of Vampire Diaries, but he's actually a bigger star in social media than he is on that show. And the interesting thing is, I mean, here's a guy that most of my friends, most people in my world have never heard of this guy. You know, we know Brad Pitt, we know Angelina Jolie, but we don't know Ian Somerhalder. But Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt, they don't have social media presences. They don't have anything. They don't, in some sense, they don't need it because they're movie stars. But this guy, Ian Somerhalder, he's got 4 million people on his Instagram feed or his Twitter feed. So in this universe, in the social media universe, he's a superstar. And that, you know, that matters. That gets you roles. That gets you, as Oliver Luckett would show, that gets you sponsors. So now by using big data and using all different kinds of software, you can see what are the overlaps in the kind of the Venn diagram between this movie star and all those products out there. And he's got enough data. He can go to a product. He can go to, you know, Ivory Soap or Origins,
upscale
beauty
skincare
supply people,
yeah.
And say, upscale skincare people, and say, look, you know, 7% of our stars' followers also follow your brand. So if you want to reach your brand, this is the spokesperson who you should use. Or more importantly, this guy's social media network is the one you want access to. So if he tweets your product, you're going to reach the audience that you are trying to reach. So now you've got really stars who need to get a social media audience in order to make it. And once they've made it, the main thing they have to sell is their social media audience.
My guest is media scholar and author Douglas Rushkoff, correspondent for the Frontline documentary Generation Like, which airs Tuesday, February 18th at 9 o'clock at night on KERA Channel 13 television. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. Sounds so old-fashioned in this world of new media. You can also send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this summer and fall to design your own master's degree in an area that matters most to you, the arts, human rights, creative writing. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author and media scholar Douglas Rushkoff. He's the correspondent for the Frontline documentary Generation Like, which you can see on Tuesday, February 18th on KERA Channel 13 television. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Doug, another thing that happens, in addition to young people tweeting to sort of catch the attention of a celebrity or maybe a corporation, they can also gain the attention of someone who has a larger online following than they do and hope that an endorsement from this bigger media star, new media star, will increase their exposure.
Yeah, there is an interesting sort of share the wealth thing where it's a bit like, like the blurbs on the back of books.
Yeah.
I guess I bring everything back to writing because I'm mainly a writer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you try to get a writer who's got more readers than you to blurb your book. You know, then you wonder, like, who's the, like, who does Malcolm Gladwell get to blurb his book? Because nobody's selling more, right, more than him. He's got to get, like, a president or something on his book to add cachet. It sort of works the same way in the social media universe, where if you've got, you know, 100 followers, you try to get someone who's got 1,000 followers to then to like you. Or that, and that person tries to get someone with 10,000, and that person tries to get one with 100,000. And what happens, though, is you'll see now like a rock video or a music video. Rock is over, I guess, at least in their culture. You know, a pop music video now gets cast based on how many followers the potential cast member has. So if you're going to put, you know, 5 pretty girls in your video just to hang out around you the way, you know, that a music star has, you're going to look not just at the girl's talent and their face and how they look on camera, but how many followers do you have? If you find a girl who's got 50,000 or 100,000 followers, you're going to pick her because when she's put into your video, she's going to be tweeting and Instagramming that she was in your video, and you're going to immediately get the benefit of those 50 or 100,000 people. So, you know, or, you know, ideally, and that's what you go to an agency for, you become part of an agency that is willing to take one of their bigger stars who has, you know, millions of followers and put them even for 2 seconds into your video. So then that star will tweet or announce to his network that he's in this new stars or up and comers video.
Has the definition of famous changed?
You know, I don't know if the definition of it has changed, but it's the sort of the end in itself quality of it is new.
Yeah.
You know, I went around with when I was going around with this. The little kid who calls himself Baby Scumbag in Los Angeles, and the film crew, you know, we were following him around, watching him do some skateboard tricks and things. All these little kids started coming up, and they kept asking, "Are you famous? Are you famous?" It wasn't, "What do you do? Are you a skateboard star? Are you a singer?" It's just, "Are you famous?" And that was the end in itself. If you're famous, then I want to be around you, because then maybe it matters, or I can get famous too. You know, when and even Tyler Oakley, the boy we were talking about before, who does lots of online marketing, you know, kind of in the guise of this everyman kid, he said when fans come up to him, when they notice him, they don't want an autograph or anything. What they want is for him to follow them. They want for him to like their social media. And that's the proof today. You know, I guess you could take a selfie with the person, but it's not your picture with the person that matters. It's whether that person, that star, that famous person puts it on their network. That's really the only thing that matters.
It's funny when you think about the pressures of being an adolescent. You know, it's no longer enough for everyone in your, you know, 7th or 8th or 9th grade class to think you're cool. Now you really need to go far beyond that and get approval from people you may never meet.
It is bizarre, isn't it? I mean, when I was a kid, you know, there was a lot of sort of, how do we say it? There was a lot of experiments that went on between me and my friends. But those experiments occurred, you know, in the parking lot of the 7-Eleven in the dead of night.
Right.
I just can't imagine what it's like to be having to have your teen years broadcast, you know, as a public thing, and not just as a public thing, but as something that only really matters, that only feels real if it's been noticed and checked and endorsed by a whole lot of people. You know, and the only way you're going to get a whole lot of people to click on what you've done, to like what you've done, is, you know, if it's kind of sensationalist, you know, is if it's, you know, well, attention getting. You know, there was a girl we met, you know, we put her right in at the end of the show. You know, sweet girl, 14, 15-year-old girl who wanted to be a singer, and her mother thought she had a beautiful voice. And you know, her mother is kind of this Rose figure from the Gypsy. You know, she got this girl. I'm going to get her. I encouraged her to sing, so they made videos and they put her singing up on the internet. And you know, she would get 50 likes, 60 likes for them from people around her town or kids in her school. And but then they started to notice, you know, if they do full body shots of her, or if she's wearing, you know, something a little bit more suggestive, she gets more hits. She gets 100 hits or 150 hits instead. So now this poor girl, she's not singing anymore. She's doing these, you know, things. She's in her bedroom talking about, you know, how to have relationships. And, you know, she's, and I don't know, you know, that her singing was necessarily going to get her on American Idol or The Voice or whatever these new talent shows are, which are themselves basically like social media, right? You're just trying to get votes on that thing. It has less to do with your talent than your ability to get liked. You know, this poor girl, she's not, I don't know what she's learning. And I feel like people don't really factor in that these platforms have values of their own that end up changing you. You know, they change the way you think. They change what you do. You can't help but be changed by the tools that you're using.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone now to Andy in Dallas. Hi, Andy.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I just find this conversation so fascinating. You know, it used to be that the idea was in social media is to find friends and connect with family and friends. And now, like you were saying, it's all about the fan base. I even saw myself right when you talked about Tyler Oakley messaging Tyler Oakley on Twitter saying, hey, they're talking about you on NPR. Think, you know, in hopes of getting some hits as myself, in hopes of getting a response also. I mean, it's all about getting a fan base. And that's what even the millennials are talking about is, you know, how many fans they have and trying to think of something novel that'll go viral. Even myself, the Dallas Geek, it was, you know, a name that I picked. It was a novel name. And, you know, even in Dallas, there are social media celebrities. And I just find the whole idea fascinating. I'll take your comment off the air.
Thanks for your call. What do you think about
it? It is interesting. You know, I think the part that I think we fail to recognize is that there are these multi-billion dollar companies who need our traffic. You know, they need us to be clicking and liking and all, so that it's sort of beneath it all is this engine that we've got to fuel. You know, it reminds me, and I kind of talk about it in the film, it reminds me a lot of the Hunger Games, where, you know, the kids are there competing in this, you know, seemingly life or death competition. They need to get liked by the audience in order to get a sponsor who's going to send them the little emergency supplies they need during the battle. And they don't really understand that the entire landscape on which they're competing has been created. It's artificial. And it's there really just to promote the agenda of people who are off screen, who are unseen to them. You know, and it's not quite as tragic, of course. These kids aren't dying, and many of them are becoming aware of just how this works and kind of the role that they're playing in it. But I think, you know, even waking up to it is troubling, because it's hard to find that many other places, other ways to express yourself, to succeed. You know, it feels like it's no longer a world that you opt into, but one that you kind of have to participate in by default.
And peer pressure has always been a factor, I mean, for people of all ages, but for teenagers in particular. But it does seem more than ever like those who hold different opinions, who have different ways of seeing the world, are going to be marginalized in a sort of focus-tested world of online social media.
Well, yeah, peer pressure has always been real, but it hasn't been supported by a multi-billion dollar industry.
Right.
You know, it used to be that marketers were trying to get people's attention away from their peers and onto their products. And now they're using peer pressure in order to promote their product. So, you know, it is a fundamentally different kind of way of organizing society. And I think that what necessarily has to happen is a real reversion to the mean. It is going to be the least common denominator kinds of cultural expressions that get rewarded in this landscape, because those are the ones that are going to get the most the most views, just like, you know, the car accident on the highway. You can't help but look, even if that's not the culture that you really want to have.
When you point this out, all of this research that you've done, Doug, into the way this works, when you point it out to young people, do they say, wow, and does it give them pause? Or do they say, I don't care, I want Taco Bell to retweet my thing and I want 100,000 people to see it?
I mean, that's kind of what I'm going to see, I guess. You know, mm-hmm. that's why I made this movie. When I made Merchants of Cool, is what, 11 years ago, and everyone thought, oh my God, kids are going to, they're not going to, you know, they're not going to respond to this. And they watched it and they were like, oh my God, you mean Sprite is paying MTV and that's not a party and this guy sold out and this did that. They were kind of, there was enough shock and awe to keep that film kind of in rotation for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the, you know, people I talked to in this film said, oh gosh, you made Merchants of Cool. That's what got me started thinking about media or, you know, becoming this or becoming that. So I'm hoping that, you know, by exposing the hidden landscape, by kind of exposing the wizard behind the curtain, it'll at least give kids pause. You know, that if they understand, just like that last caller, if they begin to understand, you know, who's in charge here, what's the real power gradient? You know, what is the promise of empowerment? And what am I being asked to pay for it? They might begin thinking about, you know, how to at least how to participate with a bit more autonomy and self-direction than just playing by the rules as they've been written.
What impression did you take away of the majority of marketing folks that you met with? I mean, on the one hand, they're sort of manipulating public opinion. On the other hand, this is what marketers have done for a long time and what companies have a right to do if they want to sell their products.
Well, the majority of them are like the rest of us. They're just flying by the seat of their pants, watching mm-hmm. this thing go and trying to participate. But the smart ones, you know, and we found a few of them, Bon and Bao at Mondelez, a snack food company, and Oliver Luckett at The Audience, and the people at TVG LA, these social media experts. They really do understand how this space works. And the combination of their brain power and their computing power, their ability to really see the way a network is communicating, the way messages move back and forth, what are the points in the network that they need to hit to create a result, it's pretty startling. They seem to be ahead of the game. And when you realize that the smartest kids out of Stanford and MIT, the ones who aren't making algorithms for Wall Street stock exchanges, are making the interfaces for these platforms. They're working at Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and Tumblr, and they're trying to make this stuff as compelling and seemingly natural as they can.
The other scary thing I would imagine from their perspective is that nobody knows what this will look like even 5 years from now and how much the game might shift.
They don't. You're right. I mean, they don't. They would think more of the same. But I think they'll reach a point of diminishing returns. Mm-hmm. You know, if you predict people so well that there's no room for doubt, you end up in a pretty boring place. You know? So I think there will always be outliers. There'll always be anomaly. There'll always be strange things that'll peek through and then cause rapid and sudden change in an unexpected direction, you know, for reasons that nobody even will be able to understand.
Douglas Rushkoff served as correspondent for the Frontline documentary Generation Like. The show airs tomorrow night, February 18th, on KERA Channel 13 Television. Doug, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, gosh, thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.